Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the mass exodus of refugees from Syria's capital, Damascus, and deepening Russian involvement with boots on the ground in support of the beleaguered Assad regime. Rafif Jujati, the English language spokeswoman for the local coordination committees in Syria, joins us for an update on the changing military situation in Syria as Russia comes to the rescue of Assad with combat aircraft and marines, while 75 US-backed rebels crossed into Syria from Turkey to fight the jihadists, bolstering the five rebels still in the fight that the US has managed to train so far at a cost of $500 million. Then we'll look into the Pope's upcoming trip to Washington, where he will be visiting President Obama and speaking to a joint session of Congress. Kenneth Briggs, who writes for the National Catholic Reporter and was a religion editor at the New York Times, joins us to discuss how the Republican-controlled Congress that has climate change deniers in leadership positions overseeing the environment will react to the Pope's address. We will also explore the extent to which conservatives in the church's hierarchy are chafing at the changes underway, while liberal clergy seem to be pushing the Pope to go beyond rhetoric and actually implement changes like allowing priests to marry. Then finally, we'll speak with Elaine Pagels, a professor of religion at Princeton University and author of Revelations, Vision, Prophecy, and Politics in the Book of Revelation. She joins us to discuss the Republican presidential candidates pandering to the religious right at Iowa's Faith and Freedom Coalition's annual dinner on Saturday, as well as the frontrunner Donald Trump's remark on Meet the Press that America already had a Muslim president, while the second-placed Ben Carson on the same program said he was opposed to a Muslim becoming president of the United States. And joining us now is Rafif Jujati, who's the founder and director of Free Syria Foundation and the English language spokeswoman for the local coordination committees in Syria, a grassroots network designed to align the activities of pro-democracy Syrians in each of the country's 14 governorates. She frequently travels to the Middle East, including Syria, and coordinates with other activists to take action and inform the public about events in Syria. Welcome to Background Briefing, Rafif Jujati.
Thank you so much, Ian.
And let's deal with the refugee crisis, particularly as it appears that much of the refugees now showing up on the Greek islands are coming from Damascus. And my understanding is that the suburbs of Damascus, at Douma area, have largely been under rebel control. Mostly the Army of Islam and al-Nusra, I understand, they are being pounded by the Syrian Air Force. So how close are they to the center of the city? And where is this exodus of refugees coming from? Are they coming from the rebel-held areas, or are they coming from the rest of the capital still under the control of the Assads?
Well, let's go back to the root of the refugee problem, which is the fact that the Assad regime continues to drop barrel bombs, cluster bombs, and all kinds of weaponry on civilians. And so, in fact, Syrian civilians are fleeing from all over the country, and they're taking whatever exits they can. Now, in the case of Douma in particular, that is a city that's been under siege for many, many months now. In fact, most cities where there is any sort of opposition have been under siege by the Assad regime. The influx of Russia only compounds the problem for fleeing civilians.
Well, is there any chance there that Damascus could fall to the rebels? I mean, most of the bombing comes from the Assad regime, who basically turned Douma into rubble. But occasionally the rebels are fired back with artillery at Damascus itself. So could we see an escalation into the Assad-controlled areas of the capital?
Well, the escalation comes and goes. The armed opposition is woefully underarmed in terms of the fight they're fighting. Now, again, with the influx of Russian superpower might into the area, I don't know that they have a chance. The armed opposition has not received the kind of support it would need to engage in any sort of decisive victory.
Well, the U.S. so far has spent $500 million training rebels, and there are only five, according to U.S. generals' recent testimony to Congress, there are only five of these U.S.-trained rebels still in the fight. And just today, I believe, 75 U.S.-backed rebels crossed into Syria from Turkey to fight the jihadists, not the Assads, but the jihadists. So, I mean, I guess that's your point, right? The Russians are pouring in not just Marines, but they're also putting combat aircraft in and anti-aircraft surface-to-air missiles, which do not have any utility against ISIS. So that is raising questions about what the Russians are actually up to.
Well, absolutely. I mean, the Russians are spreading their influence in the area. They're making Syria their final stronghold in the Mediterranean area. But they're also bolstering Assad, who we have to keep in mind is a perpetrator of massive crimes against humanity. Many of us call this the Syrian genocide because of what the Assad regime is doing. By contrast, U.S. foreign policy on Syria has been absolutely pathetic. It has been abysmal. Out of the 100 or so so-called opposition rebels they trained, they imposed a mission of defeating ISIS instead of a mission of defeating Assad. This was a policy that was doomed to begin with, and now they have five left. In fact, I think the general said 4 to 5, and so we're not quite sure of which the correct number is. The 75 soldiers crossing into Syria are expected to do what exactly?
Well, they're expected to fight the Islamic State and not Assad again. That seems to be the focus, as opposed to going after Assad.
Right. This is blatantly ridiculous, and it I suppose, is a symbol of U.S. commitment to actually helping the opposition topple a dictator, topple somebody who's being compared to Hitler from our perspective. This is absolutely ridiculous. 75 soldiers are going to combat ISIS?
Again, I'm speaking with Rafif Shujati, who's the founder and director of Free Syria Foundation and the English language spokeswoman for the local coordination committees in Syria, a grassroots network designed to align the activities of pro-democracy Syrians in each of the country's 14 governorates. She frequently travels to the Middle East, including Syria, and coordinates with other activists to take action and inform the public about events in Syria. So The U.S. and Russia, apparently, their defense ministers have been talking. They don't want necessarily the Russian combat aircraft and the U.S. combat aircraft to get into any kind of collisions or dogfights. The Russian aircraft that are coming in now do have air-to-air missiles, which again raises questions. But do you think that at some point or other the U.S. is going to join Russia, because Russia's basically saying, look, you know, accept Assad and join us and we'll get rid of ISIS together. Is that your sense that your part of the opposition, the Free Syrian opposition, if you will, are going to get sold out?
Absolutely. It's a fear that is exactly what's going to happen. We feel that our revolution has been hijacked from every possible angle. We have to keep in mind that these protests began peacefully, and they were in the name of freedom and dignity and justice for all Syrians. Now we have high-level U.S.-Russian talks that apparently are designed to combat ISIS, but we in the opposition see a very direct link between the Assad regime and ISIS. We cannot forget that the Assad regime was the one that released tens of thousands of jihadists into the streets of peaceful protests at the beginning and gave them weapons and said, go fight the fight. So we believe that ISIS begins and ends with Assad. So for us, the appropriate policy decisions to be making now are how to remove Assad from power, and secondarily, how to scale back ISIS and deter it and eliminate it.
But if there's only five fighters in the country, or four even, after $500,000 has been spent. Can you blame the US for deciding that there's no alternative to ISIS? You're saying that there was an alternative in the beginning, but what happened to the democratic opposition? Why were they overrun by the Islamists?
Well, that has multiple answers. First of all, I think what the United States is doing is recognizing its abysmal failure in terms of this foreign policy and now taking the path of least resistance. And I find that to be absolutely unacceptable. Second of all, the democratic opposition has been marginalized because, particularly from the nonviolent groups, weapons speak louder than words. And when we were able to protest in the streets, when our activists were able to engage in very creative civil disobedience, they were killed or imprisoned and tortured. With very, very little meaningful support from the West, they truly didn't stand a chance. Now, the political opposition has limited support from the West, but in a conflict where military might is what's speaking, we're not getting the kind of support we need.
And so are you saying that if the U.S. gave more support, there would be more combatants that would be going after Assad, and that would be an alternative to the Islamic State after the $500 million spent that only brought forth four or five? The long and the short of it is it's pretty hard. Wouldn't that be a pretty hard sell? What gives you the impression that there are fighters willing to fight on behalf of Syrian democracy if they're properly supplied?
I believe that the way to resolve the issue in Syria is through political, diplomatic, and military means. On the military side, I believe that the armed opposition is ready to transition to a democratic Syria. If properly supplied, it can bring that about. On the political level and diplomatic level, I believe that senior leaders from the international community need to make serious steps to engage in a political process. I don't believe they have. We've seen repeated attempts by different UN envoys and different world leaders go absolutely nowhere because the narrative is always the same. It's about transitioning Assad out of power, either gradually or right away. But the Assad regime clearly is not going to negotiate itself out of a job. And international leaders have not applied the kind of diplomatic and political pressure to nations like Russia and Iran. Both of those nations are what are keeping the Assad regime standing. This is a fundamental issue.
So if there is any alternative, where would it come from? Because my sense is that what's happening now is that you've got this vast exodus of refugees, and I'm not sure whether amongst these refugees there are people that would be willing to fight for the democratic opposition if they were properly armed. But I'm also hearing reports from the Assad-controlled areas around Latakia and Tartus, where the Russians have their bases and that they're building this air base, that one of the problems that Assad's having, which is why the Iranians, the Hezbollah, and the Russians now with their Marines are stepping in, is because the young Alawites, males, are getting the hell out of the country. And that's one of Assad's problems, that he's running out of recruits.
So this is, a many-answer
sure.
Question. First of all, I believe that the vast, vast majority of the refugees going into Europe are innocent civilians who are trying to escape both Assad's barrel bombs and chemical weapons, but also ISIS. So these are people who are seeking not better economic opportunities or a nicer lifestyle. They are hoping to survive. And it should be noted that they're moving to secular countries. I don't believe these are Islamists, and I don't believe that these are combatants who are simply fleeing. From the Assad side, in terms of the Alawite community, I believe that that community has become quite disenchanted with Bashar al-Assad and his regime. Traditionally, the Alawites have been the poorest community in Syria, despite the fact that an Alawi president has ruled Syria for close to 50 years. Second of all, these young Alawis are being rallied in the name of sectarianism, and they're no longer falling for it. They have seen too many of their children die in the name of Assad, and to what end? They're watching their entire country get destroyed. They're watching their Syrian sisters and brothers killed and become displaced. Over what? Over one family staying in power.
So what would then be the Russian motive here? Are they trying to turn the tide in Assad's favor, or are they simply building a kind of military enclave where they could maintain a foothold in the Middle East?
I think they're doing both. I think, one, they're bolstering Assad because they fear that he really cannot continue in this with any positive results for him. So they're able to show support for Assad, keep in a puppet government, and at the same time, they're reinforcing their position in Syria. So now Syrians can I think, easily say that their country is occupied by Russia, Iran, Hezbollah, and the Assad regime.
And the Islamic State.
And the Islamic State.
So all of the above is pretty hideous. Is there any chance that the situation on the ground will turn against Assad to the point where Russian, Iranian, and Hezbollah help won't be sufficient? Or is this going to just be a bloody and continuing military stalemate?
I wish I could see some sort of a silver lining here, but I think what's going to happen is a continuation of genocide. I believe that more and more refugees will flood Europe, and I think this is just going to be one of the bloodiest conflicts we've seen since World War II.
And what would your advice, because clearly you are frustrated and have been trying to get the United States to actually have a policy. Obviously, the difference here is that Iran has a policy and a strategy vis-a-vis Syria. Hezbollah has a policy and strategy vis-a-vis Syria. Russia has a policy and strategy vis-a-vis Syria. But the United States and the Western powers have been confused vacillating for some time. Do you think they'll ever come to a policy, or they'll just make a deal with the Russians?
I would hope that leadership and maturity and a sense of humanity would prevail among Western nations. I believe they've had something of an attention deficit when it's come to Syria. And I believe they've taken action very reactively in response to the threats of ISIS, in response to a refugee crisis. I think if they could sit down and formalize a plan, a strategy, and move forward, and this could be at any level, diplomatic, military, political, I think we could see some more positive results. But if history is an indicator, I think what's going to happen is that we're going to look back on this conflict in 10, 20, 30 years and say, oh, what a shame. All those people died. And for what?
Well, Rafiq Shahzadeh, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Rafiq Shahzadeh, who's the founder and director of the Free Syria Foundation and the English language spokeswoman for the local coordination committees in Syria, a grassroots network designed to align the activities of pro-democracy Syrians in each of the country's 14 governorates. She frequently travels to the Middle East, including Syria, and coordinates with other activists to take action and inform the public about events in Syria. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into the Pope's upcoming trip to Washington. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Kenneth Briggs, who writes for the National Catholic Reporter. He's a professor at Lafayette College and a former New York Times religion editor, and is the author of Power of Forgiveness and Double Crossed, Uncovering the Catholic Church's Betrayal of American Nuns. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kenneth Briggs.
Thank you very much.
And the Pope is in Havana, Cuba. He spoke in Revolution Square, and obviously he's getting a huge and enthusiastic reception. He also met privately with Raul Castro, but they've had a private dialogue for some time. After all, it was the Pope who brought about, did the groundwork for this historic deal, the rapprochement between the U.S. and Cuba after 60 years of a ridiculous stalemate and a boycott. Mm-hmm. So I guess this Pope really is quite a diplomat, isn't he?
That remains to be seen on the larger scale. He certainly has all the personal qualities of one, whether he has the resolve to follow out difficult issues and problems is another thing. So the follow-through is still to be seen. It may well be there, but he's certainly got the skills personally to do it.
So how's these skills going to come into play in Washington? He meets with Obama on Tuesday, and I think it's Wednesday that he's speaking to a joint session of Congress. My understanding that a lot of the opposition he's getting, not just in the Curia from the cardinals who maybe have some bias remorse about him being the Pope in the first place, and the fact that there's still obviously vestiges of tremendous number of very conservative cardinals who are appointed by the Pope's two predecessors who were extremely conservative. So that's one battle he's got. But my understanding is that the recent encyclical on the environment has really brought about a lot of political backlash.
Yes. The cardinals in Rome are almost like the senior team of lawyers in an old law firm, and the new head of the team comes in and starts shuffling people around, and so they get into lots of internecine warfare over it and resist changing the status quo. So that is one almost completely insider kind of story. And the other has to do with the world. The cardinals may have buyer's remorse, but most Catholics don't. And I think most bishops don't for this reason. I believe the underlying, either conscious or unconscious, reason he was elected Pope was to change the face and the narrative of the Catholic Church in the public domain, quite outside the Church, also including Catholics, but also outside the Church. Until he was elected, there was a total downward spiral in publicity about the Church. It was almost entirely negative. It had to do with child abuse, scandal, money problems, all kinds of coercion that was being alleged here and there. And I think they wanted somebody who could make a great first impression, and they got it. They may not like the words that come after. They may not like some of the sentiments. They may not like some of the gestures. But I think they like the first pass that he makes on an audience is one that elicits enormous enthusiasm and charm and warmth and all that. It's when we get down to the words that the separations start to come. I'm not sure that this trip matters all that much to the wider Catholic community in terms of words. I think Marshall McLuhan was right. The medium is the message. I think the trip will be a kind of pleasant, glowing blur on the minds of most American Catholics, who who like him without knowing exactly what he's doing, except that he sounds like he's doing them a favor and sounds like he's making the church more acceptable and appealing and hospitable and generous and all that, without having anything to prove that he is. So it's really mixed. And conservatives are very nervous and very edgy at this point, because the encyclical on the environment touches upon real economic issues that they are very concerned about, namely the disruption of a kind of capitalist free enterprise march without restriction. And the encyclical suggests restriction, cutting back, changing our lifestyle, maybe even affecting economic growth in certain discrete ways among the most affluent people. So there's a lot of waves going on among Catholic conservatives and other conservatives that he's kind of going to side with those anti-free enterprise forces. And that's where the rubber really hits the road with most of those people. The religious issues, not so much, but this one has to do with money and industry and economies.
Well, of course, the idea that dealing with global warming is going to lead to economic catastrophe, which is the argument, for example, that Marco Rubio, the candidate on the Republican side for president, made the other night at their second debate, is largely an oil company argument. And obviously, we just saw the defeat here in California of a bill that Governor Brown and the legislature, the heads of the legislature, were pushing as a part of a climate change package ahead of the conference in Paris in December, that they were going to cut gasoline consumption in cars by 50% by the year 2030. The oil company lobbyists just absolutely invaded Sacramento and killed it and bought off all the young Democratic legislators. So they're very proactive, but that doesn't mean that it's a rational economic argument. The green people have equal arguments that may actually be more effective and more job-friendly, and that is the idea that if we started to develop a green economy, that would create jobs as opposed to losing jobs in the oil patch.
I think that the Pope in the encyclical, and he's not the first one to enunciate these principles, it goes back to Benedict and it goes back to John Paul II. I mean, they kind of were leading up the same alley. But I think the green argument is something that they have made some kind of contribution to, and I think this encyclical makes a contribution to. And yes, they have thought about its intellectual, economic, and theological roots, and I think that they do make an argument on that basis, and its biblical roots too. I think what the Pope is talking about in this encyclical is the common good. And I think that's a different calculus from the profit-making alone good. And I think the turning of attention to the common good and what would be a way of preserving life as well as at least promoting strong economies goes right back to Catholic social teaching that has been the product of 150 years or so, which is encoded in encyclicals that go back to Pope Leo XIII at the end of the 19th century, that really endorse this idea that we are all in this together and need to be accountable. And so I think he's on very firm ground with this. And it's a case of those who would prefer that he keep the religion too reserved to issues that sound religious, that sound pious or have to do with beliefs and not have to do with the common social, economic, and political good. And I think the Bible and Catholic tradition do not support the go it alone, unregulated self-enterprise kind of thing. It would support exactly the kind of direction the Pope is pointing in.
Well, but he's going to be speaking to a Republican-controlled Congress at the joint session that he's addressing. Many of the leaders that have oversight over the environment are global warming deniers, both in the House and the Senate. This is a Tea Party-run Congress, if you will, at least Tea Party-dominated mm-hmm. Congress, that are now, you know, possibly going to, at least the Tea Party wing of the party, is probably going to elect a casino owner, thrice married libertine, as president of the United States. So you've got this peculiar, and there, you know, and he's, I don't know how much of a global warming denier Trump is, but the point I'm making here is that this is a party that is in the process of embracing somebody in the name of Christian values who is just a horrible, ignorant, racist bigot.
Well, and I think the Pope is pretty keen about keeping track of these developments, and I think he's coming at a time that he really understands could be the tipping point in one direction or another as to where Christians line up on climate change over the next years. And I mean the solid majority of what Christian point of view turns out to be the dominant one, and that he can have a voice in that by the encyclical and speaking to Congress. And I think that is where he wants to put his effort. Whether it succeeds or not is something else, but I think he sees the stakes as being very high and wants to be on the right side, or what he considers, and I think rightly so, the Christian side of that issue. But the other thing that I've been sort of nagging about and haven't really got anywhere with is to find out exactly how much money the Vatican has invested in the oil industry. And assuming that it's a fair chunk, there's something like $9 billion in the that's an estimate, and of course those things are kept very secret, but that's been the one that's been bandied about the most. $9 billion or so in investments, in foreign investments. And to what extent is that in fossil fuels? And if it is, I think it would make a whole lot of difference if the Pope said, we're taking our money out of the fossil fuel business as a gesture of support for those who want to fight climate change. And I think asking the institution itself to make a sacrifice on that behalf, I think would have a much greater effect than simply stating his position and the position, as right as it may be. He needs some action to back up what he's saying, and I think that could be a start.
Well, you know, we were talking earlier about pressure from the conservatives, who obviously are pretty well entrenched in the Curia. And you know, one of the jokes is that the reason that the Pope lives in the Vatican Hotel and doesn't live in the palace is that he eats at the cafeteria at the Vatican Hotel, and that means they can't poison him in the palace. He did take on the Vatican Bank. He actually acted very, very resolutely and fired a whole bunch of people. So he's shown the ability to clean house a little bit. But on the other side, when you talked about him, basically they needed a fresh face because they were just spiraling downward in negative publicity, that almost suggested to me that, you know, he's kind of a Barack Obama, somebody who promises hope and change, but the system is such that he can't deliver on all of those promises or even some of those promises. So on the liberal side, is there disappointment? I mean, for example, Bishop Francis Anthony Quinn, the Bishop Emeritus of Sacramento, California, had an op-ed in the New York Times on, I think it was Saturday, calling for the Pope to realize that you can't fix the problem of the lack of recruits for priests in the Catholic Church unless you allow priests to marry. And that strikes me as a possible pressure from the left, if you will, of the Catholic Church, saying, you know, okay, put your money where your mouth is.
Yeah, absolutely. There is a lot of disquiet on increasing disquiet on the liberal side of those who actually understand the issues. They say, if you're going to talk about, you know, in what's quoted in the paper as a more liberal attitude, say, toward women, then you got to do something about it. And the annulment announcement that was treated as such a major event was, yes, it's a refinement of the system, but the system is in place. The system that really people have objected to and worked against for so long, the annulment, the whole annulment concept, stays right in place, and so on and so on and so on. And there hasn't been yet a clear, concrete expression of desire to change the way the things are taught and enacted within the church that matters to liberals. And not even really fiery liberals either, just people who want something done about, say, a married priesthood or some kind of practical business that has to do with how many priests are going to be available in the diocese to, and will our church have a pastor, all that kind of stuff. So that's the worry among liberals, that he may not have any intention to follow through with institutional ramifications, because, as we know, popularity does not necessarily translate into policy. I mean, other popes have been very popular, John the 23rd even, and John Paul II were enormously popular in their own right. And during that whole period of time, the Catholic Church in America has slid downward, so that now 31 or let's say roughly a third of those born Catholics in America are no longer practicing Catholics. And so popularity will only get you so far. Institutional restructuring and shifting of teachings will, I think, do a tremendous amount. So a lot of waiting and watching and saying, after the first flush of excitement over his tremendous appeal, what happens next, and who's gonna lead it, and where's it gonna come from? Just and one little footnote: he seems to be someone who believes, as a Jesuit, that he's seen things work better if you devolve power, if you don't put it all in one place, but it rises up from the people, so that he can do, as some presidents always vow to do, run against Washington, which is in this case Rome, and appeal to the broad masses to kind of help generate change from if not the bottom up, almost the bottom up. Mm-hmm. But there's no way to do that the way the church is now has been run for so long, with all the power concentrated at the top and only concentrated in ordained males from priests on up. So seems to me, if you want something more democratic, you have to kind of edge in that direction, and that hasn't happened yet.
Right.
He's only been there 2.5 years, so maybe.
Well, just in closing then, is this a case then of the Pope? First of all, he's closed the door on ordaining women. He made that really clear. So that's not going to happen. But they haven't, doctrinally, they haven't closed the door on married priests. They accepted the conservative Anglican priests who operate as Catholic, married Catholics. There's an op-ed in today's Sunday's New York Times about my father, the priest. So there's room to move there. Why doesn't he move?
I think he wants the Synod of Bishops that's coming up. I think he wants them to get closer to it rather than having him put his stamp on it before it happens. He's got a hope, and maybe it's valid, that it's going to work, that the bishops are going to wake up somehow and come to this consciousness and decide through some type of consensus that this needs to change. And I don't see any precedent for it, but who knows? There have been times in church history that the church has been run on a conciliar basis, more like almost like a parliamentary system where cardinals and bishops kind of decided these things more than the Pope did. And then the popes would get upset and they'd revert more to a I'm the boss kind of approach that made it much more centered in the Pope. And then it would devolve a little bit into
parliamentary,
consultative.
Yeah. Well, I thank you for joining us, Kenneth Briggs. I appreciate it.
Thanks very much.
And again, I've been speaking with Kenneth Briggs, who writes for the National Catholic Reporter. He's a professor at Lafayette College and a former New York Times religion editor, and is the author of Power and Forgiveness and Double Crossed, Uncovering the Catholic Church's Betrayal of American Nuns. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back discussing the Republican presidential candidates pandering to the religious right at Iowa's Faith and Freedom Coalition annual dinner. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Elaine Pagels, who's a professor of religion at Princeton University and the author of many books, including The Gnostic Gospels, Reading Judas, and the New York Times bestseller, Beyond Belief. She is the author of the new book, Revelations, Vision, Prophecy, and Politics in the Book of Revelation. Welcome to Background Briefing, Elaine Pagels.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
And how do you explain the fact that this brash Manhattan so-called billionaire who is clearly arrogant, foul-mouthed, money-obsessed, thrice married, and yet somehow, and was up until recently was pro-choice, yet somehow he is the... seems to be the choice of conservative Christian voters. He spoke at the Iowa Faith and Freedom Summit on Saturday and was enthusiastically received. So go figure.
Well, it's hard for me to imagine why anybody would choose Donald Trump for anything, but nevertheless, I'd just like to say he must know this works. It worked for George Bush. In fact, I saw George W. Bush. I happened to see a film that was done by his campaign team for the second election, George W. Bush, and it was shown, I was told, in 300,000 evangelical churches. And it showed the young George Bush, you know, he's a sinner, he drinks too much, then walks on the beach with Billy Graham, his soul is saved, and, you know, it belongs to Jesus. And now he has an Iraq war to finish, and God wants him to do it and has told him he has to do this work. And that, you know, that plays. It's not a new game. And as you know, I mean, religion is very deep in this country and has, I've been aware of, especially since Bush's election and what's happening now, of the tremendous potential for igniting emotional power that, that these religions have. So Trump is obviously aware of that and using it.
So then does this mean that the actual life of Jesus as a parable, as an example, the text, the books, particularly the New Testament, the Beatitudes, all of what's on the record in terms of Christian doctrine indicates the opposite of what much of these people believe in?
Well, you're totally right. But it doesn't matter because people can always choose something else. I mean, you can choose the apocalyptic scenario of, you know, the rise of evil in the world like ISIS, right? And that's what Bush chose when he talked about Saddam Hussein as evil. And he talked about a crusade. And I don't know whether he was actually believes that or doesn't, but it doesn't matter. The point is he used it and it worked. And striking to me, because one of my colleagues at Princeton, Bernard Heichel, is a specialist on ISIS, and he says you've got to take ISIS not as a political movement with a religious pretext, but these are serious religious Muslims, very radical, who want to take over the world in the name of Allah. And what he told me made me realize that they are exactly the inverse of our evangelicals.
Meaning?
In the way that they see the world. Well, the good and evil are battling in the world. We're on the side of good. They're on the side of evil. We have to destroy them.
Well, this symbiosis, though, has been pretty apparent to me that, you know,
yes.
George W. Bush's war on terror. How do you fight a war against religious fanatics if you're in bed with them at home? I mean, the distinctions, you know, we've never really dealt with the theocratic basis of much of the belief systems amongst American evangelicals and fundamentalists, whereas we make it real clear that these are dangerous theocrats in the Middle East. And as I mentioned in the opening, you know, we've got Dr. Ben Carson on Meet the Press on Sunday saying that he would not approve of a Muslim becoming president. So here we are, you know, in the midst of, you know, Islam bashing or Muslim bashing, Islamophobia, and we seem to be completely in denial about the fact that there may be, you know, Christo-fascists, to coin a phrase, as well as Islamo-fascists.
Well, you know, I think you're totally right. And I remember I was at a conference some years ago in Sweden, international conference, people talking about, is fundamentalism increasing? And a lot of them were saying yes. And what I came away with was yes, fundamentalism is increasing on all sides, Islamic and Christian. And so is it's increasing in the same way that a greater openness to liberal views on religion is increasing, you know? So it's not one or the other. It's actually they're both happening at the same time. I mean, many more people are aware of Islam. You see these television programs that are now all in the family kind of program, including Islam. Halal in the Family, is it?
Mm-hmm.
So many people are much more open. And that evokes the same reaction of violent negativity from people who have the reaction of fear instead of openness.
Well, the thing that I find, I mean, I think what you're just telling us was reflected the other day when Bernie Sanders spoke at Liberty, Jerry Falwell's college. He had a huge enthusiastic reception with the young millennials who are much more tolerant on, you know, issues of gay marriage and homosexuality, et cetera. They're much more inclusive and inclusive and not as obsessed, you know, to quote Pope Francis, who are we to judge, you know?
yes. Isn't that interesting? Yeah. I mean, and that really worries their elders, you know?
Right.
The fact that they are softening on issues of race and difference of religion, they're probably more used to seeing people who look different, whose religions are different, who are Indian or Muslim or Hindu or, you know, Buddhist or atheist, that alarms their elders, and those people get more and more ferocious in proportion to their, you know, the change the other way. I think both of those are absolutely happening, and seeing it come out in our politics is unfortunately no surprise. It's appalling, I agree.
But I think, Elaine Pagels, if you watch evangelical television, and you try to be objective, as a political scientist, I think you have to come away with the conclusion that much of televangelism is a front for right-wing politics, and that may explain the fact that on September the 28th, a prominent televangelist, Paula White, is going to lead a delegation of evangelical leaders to meet with Donald Trump in Trump Tower. And it's not as if they're distancing himself from it. When he doubled down and refused to repudiate an ugly remark by one of his supporters at a rally, he was cheered at the Iowa prayer breakfast or prayer meeting.
Absolutely true. Although, as you just have demonstrated, Pope Francis is not politically indifferent either. I mean, he's encouraging particular kinds of decisions in society and politics, just as Jeb Bush said he won't take advice from his church on this, but he was being given it, you know, on issues of climate change. I mean, I think religiously committed people are not going to leave that alone, of course. I mean, on both sides. What do you think?
Well, this is, I guess, the eternal puzzlement that I have about America is the religious right, is its bark worse than its bite? Is the religious left somnambulant, or is it basically just quietly getting on with its work? I mean, I'm not sure about the balance of power here in terms of the religious right and the religious left. The conventional wisdom is that the religious right have taken over, and the religious left are just not stepping up to the plate.
I just think of the poem by Yeats, when he talked in 1919, he said the worst lack all conviction and the best lack all conviction and the worst are full of passionate intensity. I mean, there is a passionate intensity in the right. That's true. But I do see people on the liberal side, and that has to do, you know, with the different attitudes about sexuality, about people of other faiths, and so forth. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure it's a balance. I wouldn't go that far.
Well, then, can you pass it in terms of intellectualism and education? Because we were talking earlier before we went on the air. I mentioned a poll that gave the number of Americans who believe in creationism or don't believe in evolution. And this was a Gallup poll that came out last year, and it said 42% of Americans believe in creationist views and not in evolution. And there was just a poll that came out a couple of days ago from PPP and said that 54% of Republicans believe that Obama is a Muslim and wasn't born in the United States. So you combine those two things, you have to sort of assume that there's a kind of aggressive anti-intellectualism underway in this country.
Yes, you know, when you mentioned that, it's appalling. But I do think it sounded to me, frankly, as if it was directed against Obama, you know, the intellectual, the Harvard, you know, so forth. I mean, and that could also be a kind of racist response. I mean, I see it as racism. They absolutely detest the man. It's worse than that. They abominate him. So saying that, you know, these intellectuals are idiots is one way of attacking the president. I think it's bigger than that, but
But if we're slouching towards Bethlehem, as the Yeats poem pointed out, that the best are lack conviction, and the worst among us are full of passion and intensity. If that's the case, do you think that there's any way that if the religious right throws its lot behind Trump, and eventually that will be, I think, proved to be probably a disaster, will it taint them in any way? Is there any way, as I say, we were saying earlier, the very book that they pretend or say that it is that their lives are guided by, quite often contradicts most of what their belief systems are. So I just wonder if at the end of the day, faith is stronger than fact.
Well, for some people it certainly is, or shall we say prejudice is. I mean, it would be astonishing if they would go for Donald Trump. I suspect the only reason would be that they think he could win. I mean, which seems to me very far-fetched, but then I hope I'm out of touch with it.
Well, but he'll win in the arena that they dominate, which is the Republican primary arena. He won't win in the general. I don't think anybody expects that. But that just shows you there's a sort of...
It could be. It could be, because there's not another candidate that they think has that kind of clout. I mean, it can't be religious conviction that compels that decision, do you think?
Well, no, they've got a pastor there, Huckabee. They could go for, they could go for him, and they're clearly not, you know. But then again, you know, back in 1980, they had a choice between a divorced Hollywood actor and a genuine Southern Baptist preacher who taught Sunday school, who got elected.
yes. And I mean, to say that Obama is a Muslim, though, I mean, that's what I meant by what sounds like a racist comment. He's just too dark-skinned, you know, to be one of us. And when the last election people ran on the program, you know, we want our country back, who did they want it from? I think it's those dark-skinned people like Barack Obama, you know.
Right. Well, the little 14-year-old boy down in Texas who brought a digital alarm clock to school, you know. I don't really heard about that. Well,
yes, I did.
Elaine Pagels, it's enjoy the conversation very much, and I hope we can talk again and perhaps have some celebration of the better angels of our nature.
Well, I hope so. I hope so. We need a prophet here.
We do. And I thank you for joining us. Again, I've been speaking with Elaine Pagels, who's professor of religion at Princeton University and the author of many books, including The Gnostic Gospels, Reading Judas, and the New York Times bestseller, Beyond Belief. She's the author of the new book, Revelations, Vision, Prophecy, and Politics in the Book of Revelation. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.